Hello, Charlene, are you there?
Hi, Scott.
Hey,
Yes.
welcome, welcome. Yes, well, if you're going live, one thing you know is everything's going to go wrong, isn't
It is, despite all of our
it?
best efforts.
It's a great way to begin. I thought what I'd do to start with is just do a little kind of intro spiel that gives a bit of context, and then hand over to you to introduce yourself.
Okay.
It is intended to be a conversation, so it's not going to be too formal. All right, I'll dive straight in then. So, welcome to the first Curiosity Conversation with me, your host, Scott Drummond. Throughout January, I'm reading, researching, writing about, and practicing courage. And as part of that practice, I've decided to host a series of live Curiosity Conversations with people I know, to delve further into the topic and to learn more about different people's experience of courage. So joining me today is Charlene. Charlene and I met each other going through Coactive Coach training and have kept in contact. Charlene, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Lovely to have you. It'd be great if you could share a little bit about yourself. I'll leave it up to you what you want to say, just to give listeners a sense of who you are and what you're bringing to this curiosity conversation.
Okay. So like you said, we met during coach training, but before that, I was a police officer, and a hostage negotiator and a special victims detective. Grew up in California and yeah, just kind of do now I still do a lot of investigations and advocacy and working around trauma and special interest, things like that. So have dealt with courage personally, from my personal perspective, but also with others for since before I can remember. But most recently, I think I really got an intimate look at it because of a diagnosis that I had with exercise-induced anaphylaxis. And I don't know if you want me to go into that right now.
Yeah, well, listen, we're there, right? It
Okay.
seems, you know, and by way of background, Charlene shared a piece of writing recently, or a piece of Charlene's writing came across my desk, and in it she talks about this experience that she's been having around, well, I'll let you describe it, Charlene, a diagnosis that's forced you to confront courage pretty much daily.
Yeah. So, I got diagnosed with a really rare condition called exercise-induced anaphylaxis, and basically it means that I'm allergic to exercise. Kind of the tragic irony of it all is that in order to not have not go into anaphylaxis, I have to exercise. The less I exercise, the more sensitive I am to going into anaphylaxis at lower intensity activities. So I build up my resilience by actually exercising more and more. But the courage piece of that is that basically every time I put on my sneakers to go exercise, I know like in the back of my mind that this can be the one time that I go into anaphylaxis and I can't reverse it and I die. I mean, that's the worst case scenario, right? And there's no predictability to the episodes. So, kind of like a daily conscious realization that any day could be my last, really.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, what? Yeah.
I have to
What?
laugh at it, right? You have to like the
Right.
world. It's like I've worked in all of these dangerous fields all of my life, but that's always been an external threat. So to some to a rational mind, you can kind of mitigate, oh, I can do X, Y, and Z to protect myself from an external threat. But this is literally like my own body is fighting against me. So it's
And
different.
yeah, I wanted to ask because obviously in your career, you will have had many occasions where you've had to show courage. Presumably, you know, talk to me a little bit about the difference in the type of courage you've got to show as a hostage negotiator, as a special investigations officer, versus the kind of courage you have to show when you go out for a run, not knowing whether you know, that's going to be a life or death situation for you.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. This is a new diagnosis for me. It's been about 2 years that I've been dealing with this, so it's been a discovery process for me. But as I've kind of reflected back on some of the critical incidents that I've dealt with, I kind of realized that I, had I not had those experiences, I think I would be experiencing this condition right now in a very different way. But I probably wouldn't have the resilience to tackle it mentally right now. If I didn't have the history of overcoming some pretty adverse situations. It's different in the sense that, like, one of my earliest, it kind of dances with death is how I call it. Before I even became a police officer, I was in high school, and prior to leaving for university, I was standing in the front of my house, and while a gunman opened fire, like, directly at me, and I wasn't hit. And that experience, you know, I walked away from that, and I just thought, going forward, every time something seemed challenging or scary to me, I always thought back to that incident and thinking, well, you know, if that didn't kill me, then this certainly can't. You know, it was always like a comparison.
Right.
Like, you know,
yeah.
If I live through that, then I can live through everything. It was always an if-then. So that kind of, like, created the foundation for me that, you know, if I can withstand a threat coming from an external source, as lethal as that, then, you know, I can do anything. I never considered, though, that the threat would come from my own body, though, right?
So
the difference, I think, now is that it's really like an internal negotiation that I have with my body. It's like my spirit negotiates with my body every time that I go out. I promise that, okay, I'm going to be present and aware, and I'm going to listen to every sign and signal that you give me, so that if you start to want to stop, then, you know, I'll pay attention and I'll take the right mitigations. And then from my body side, my body is like, okay, I'll let you go as far as you think you're going to go, but when I'm tired, I'm sitting down, you know? So it's really just, I feel like there's this other person, like, living in me, and we just have to learn to live together. It's odd.
It's
a split personality.
What really strikes me about it is almost, you know, it's a level of self-awareness, you know, it's a level of self-reflection that's hard won for a lot of people. They spend a lot of time in their life running away from themselves or not really turning to face themselves. This diagnosis, you know, makes it absolutely necessary. I mean, absolutely imperative that you stay very mindfully present to what's going on in your body and how you're feeling. And I love the way you described it as a negotiation. I wonder, you know, your training as a hostage negotiator, does this come into play here?
Yeah, most definitely. And, you know, and it's kind of ironic to the timing of it, because I had just kind of mastered being able to zone out when I exercise, so that I can kind of, like, surpass the feeling of pain or what have you when you do, like, endurance sports or something really challenging. Because mentally, I always want to push myself as far as I can. And most times when you're working out, it's the pain that stops you. Your mind can go forever, right? But it's the pain that stops you. So I had gotten into the habit of just kind of meditating or zoning out of the physical sensation of my body so that I could go further. And then all of a sudden I got this diagnosis, and now I've got to listen to everything again. I'm irritated.
it's like your body decided to create this diagnosis to get you back into connection, right? To get you out of that mindlessness or that pushing away of the sensations.
Exactly.
It's odd.
I mean, how do you do it? You do that cold water swimming, right? So you.
Right. Yeah.
How do you deal with that? The mental and the physical, like, aspect of feeling that cold when you go in. Like, how do you feel when you go swimming like that?
You know, it's so much of what you said resonates, albeit, let's just be clear, not in such a life or death situation. But I guess the first thing is sometimes I really don't want to go in, right? you know, the anticipation of the sensation is enough to make me sort of, yeah, already the excuses are running. The script is going over in my head saying, well, you're very busy today. You know, you probably can't get down there. Maybe the waves will be too big. You shouldn't risk it. And then, you know, that's where the sort of like that natural learned aversion to discomfort, pushing discomfort away, saying, you know what, it's warm, I'm dry, why on earth am I putting myself outside my comfort zone? So that's there almost every day, quieter or louder depending on the day. And then as what I've been practicing is the Wim Hof method. For those listening who don't know, Wim Hof is a practitioner of cold immersion and a particular style of breath work or breathing technique and mindset kind of setting, he calls it. And he combines these three things together as a sort of therapeutic and personal growth methodology. So I've done a little bit of work around this. And I think what's really crucial is there are those three elements, right? It's not just about diving headlong into freezing cold water and, you know, then being really tough and taking whatever it brings to you. The first stage is about setting your mind, you know, almost stealing your mind, I guess, for the discomfort that's to come, and knowing in your mind that what's to come, you know, you can welcome it in. You don't have to, you know, put on a suit of armor and get ready for a fight. You can know that the cold, and this is a phrase I use all the time, Wim Hof uses it, and I just love it. He says, the cold is my warm friend. It doesn't make any sense at all, but I love this attitude of friendliness, right? It's almost like, you know what? The cold isn't here as an adversary. It's not something I have to triumph over or fight against. It's actually a friend. You know, it's somebody I can trust in. It's a place I can go that's going to teach me something and tell me something. So I set my mind, you know, I say it out loud. I'm there stripping off on the beach, say, the cold is my warm friend. I usually have a big smile on my face because I know that helps as well. Mm-hmm. And then the breathwork exercise is really almost an ecstatic breathwork. So it's a kind of almost like a hyperventilation style. When you're doing it, you start to get the tingling sensation throughout your body. And it's priming the nervous system, right? It's getting it ready, you know, pumped up in a sense for what's to come. So the combination, I think, of this friendly attitude, you know, the cold is my warm friend, and actually like engaging my body, getting it ready physically, means that when you finally step into the water, everything else sort of recedes. And what I really focus on then is just my breath. You know, because one of the great gifts of getting into freezing cold water is it takes your breath away, literally. So the first thing that happens is you can't really get your breath. You sort of have that shortness of breath. And it's a reminder to just pause, just take a moment, and then just try and find your breath. Literally go searching for that slightly deeper breath and get back to that breathing pattern that feels both comfortable and also is just, you know, a bit deeper and a bit fuller. So you're just oxygenating the body while it's in the water as well. You're keeping, you know, that mindset in mind as well. And then really at that point, you just get to enjoy it. It is actually the truth, you know. The cold sensation at the moment, the water's about 9 degrees. So it's cold, but it's not that cold, right? Wim Hof and other people are ice bathing every day, that sort of thing. But 10 degrees is cold enough to get your attention for sure. And so once you're in there, you really, you know, if your mind is set in the right way and you're focusing and you're breathing, it becomes a meditation of sorts. And the cold itself doesn't really intrude on that meditation particularly. You're aware of it, but it's not the whole deal, right? You're focused on other things. And I heard a really, really great quote. It came from The Call to Courage, Brené Brown's Netflix special. And in that, she talks about how vulnerability often shows up in us as a sort of almost like that pit of your stomach feeling, the slightly kind of nervous feeling, right? And one response to that can be a kind of fear or a shrinking. And another great response, and in her research, this particular response correlates really closely with experiences of joy, which I found really interesting. So the response that can come from vulnerability and this kind of sensation of almost fear rising up, you know, in the face of that vulnerability is gratitude, right? When we're faced with, oh my goodness, I'm not sure, we can turn our mind to gratitude and say, what am I really grateful for here? And that can bring on this kind of sense of joy. You know, that vulnerability is an openness, you know, and then coupled with gratitude can bring this kind of sense of joy. So one of the things I've been trying to practice as much as possible too, is once I'm in the water, you know, is having this attitude of friendliness, really relaxing into my breath and then taking a look around. You know, it's amazing. You know, the sea is so breathtaking in its own way. The sunset, you know, the horizon, seeing other people on the shore, you know, there's so much that I can be grateful for. And I really choose to take that gratitude practice into the sea. And I find that helps hugely. So at this stage, you know, the courage kind of comes into it almost in it being a discipline and a practice. The courage is saying, I'm going to show up for this every day, you know, because mm-hmm. I know it's good for me. I know it's stretching me. I know it's keeping me in, you know, just outside of my comfort zone. And what I think is kind of interesting and maybe quite different to your experience, given your condition, the more I'm going in the water, the less courageous I have to be, right? The less sort of courageous it feels I have to be to get into the water. You know, from day to day, it changes. Some days I'm not really as into it. Other days I'm absolutely, you know, really excited to get in. But I'm kind of now at the point where I'm seeking out what else can I do to stretch myself? What else can I do to bring on that feeling of like, uh-oh, this feels a little bit uncomfortable, as a way to deliberately practice courage? I guess my question to you is, I wonder, you know, is that the same for you with your condition? And does it feel like you're making progress in terms of, you know, building up a kind of resilience around the condition?
Yeah, that's interesting that you bring that up. A couple things. Yeah, so initially, because I was going into anaphylaxis probably like, I don't know, 3 times a month.
Wow.
Or so it was a lot, right? So the fear was really amplified every time I would work out. But as I kind of built up my tolerance to it, now it doesn't happen as frequently. So it may only be like, you know, once every, I don't know, 6 months or so.
Right.
So I don't feel as fearful every time I work out. But the kind of catch 22 to that is that I know the longer that I go without going into anaphylaxis, the more imminent it will probably become. So I get into this almost like place of complacency almost. And then this little voice in my head goes, ooh, you haven't gone into anaphylaxis recently. I bet it's coming. And then so the anticipation, then I start to kind of feel anxious around, I kind of forgot. You kind of forget like what that feeling, well, you don't forget, but you kind of put that memories of that feeling to the back of your mind when you haven't had it in so long. And then when you start to think, okay, it's probably coming again, then you start to, you know, fear the potential of it happening again. So it is, it's a bit of a roller coaster.
Yeah, wow.
But I can totally resonate with what you said about, you know, after you accomplish that, then you want to look for, you know, how else you can push yourself, right? Because I'm doing sports too, and every time I do like an extreme activity that's been on my bucket list, then it's kind of like, oh, now what can I do to top that?
Right. You know? Yeah,
so
of course.
I totally get that. I wanted to say too, to your piece, the quote that you talked about, the cold being your warm friend, and kind of make peace with that. But that fear, or that thing that that produces the fear in you, it's the same thing that I do with my condition, right? So I refer to the anaphylaxis as Anna. Like I've personified the condition. This girl named Anna lives with me, and we have this banter back and forth in my head. She's got a personality and everything, and we kind of have this playful conversation with each other, like, you know, at different times. So it is kind of just making friends with, you know, the enemy.
Right. And, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies even closer, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You mentioned the sort of, I guess, the bucket list of items, you know, And one thing that I've been looking basically at my life and trying to say, okay, where am I sitting in my comfort zone right now? What could I do to kind of gently stretch myself outside of that? And what might I learn while I'm doing it? I'm not really looking for experiences where I'm going to be kind of so under stress or so under duress that maybe I don't have an opportunity to reflect or make sense of the experience. I'm looking for kind of smaller pushing outside of my comfort zone. So recently I went down onto the beach and decided, like, before I went for my swim, I'd just dance. So I put some headphones in and I was just like throwing shakes on the beach, and a bunch of people just standing there sort of looking at me like I've lost it completely, you know. I mean, it's nothing really, right? It's just dancing on a beach. But it's funny how self-conscious we can feel about our body and about how we take space. And that's something for me, I know I've been thinking about lately. So for me, dancing is really like stepping into that discomfort of saying, you know what, I'm really happy to be here. I'm going to express myself joyfully with my body. And similarly, just a couple of days ago, I went down and I thought, I'm going to sing. I'm going to sing really loud. So I, before I went into the sea, almost as a form of like, you know, stealing myself again, I knelt down on the beach and I sung a song really, really loud. And again, people are, so, you know, really, I mean, listen, I live in Brighton. It's a pretty open-minded place. I think if I went to some other places and started singing, maybe the police would arrive and stick me in the back of a wagon or something. But in Brighton, you know, down on the beach, people are turning around and looking and sort of, you know, thinking, wow, what's going on with this guy? And I think part of it is also, you know, a sort of learned cultural response of, you know, don't take space, you know, don't be the one who's loud and, you know, standing in your power. And so for me, a little bit of, you know, that stepping into discomfort is about, you know, I'm seeking those things. I want to feel more able to stand in my power, to take space when I need to take it. And I'm exploring what that feels like with these little practices. I'm curious for you, Charlene, what are some of the things that kind of, you know, maybe cause you a little bit of fear and anxiety right now, and therefore, you know, by dint of that, become a practice in courage because you're having to stretch beyond your comfort zone? What might some of those be?
Things make me uncomfortable. That's a tough question, I think, because I think uncertainty makes me fearful, like the anticipation of different outcomes. But I always try and bring myself back to the realization that I'm fearing an eventuality that I don't know may not ever happen. So I kind of just bring myself back to the present and think to myself, like, what's here now? And then I'm like, whatever. But then I also kind of think, too, that I remind myself that fear is a learned response. You brought that up. And I think back to my youngest daughter when I was potty training her. I remember one night, she just woke up in the middle of the night. We went to the bathroom, and she literally fell in the toilet. And I remember for that split second, she looked at me, and we were looking at each other, and it was just both of us were like deer in the headlights. And I just started laughing, and then she laughed too. And I was thinking that, you know what? She was looking at my face to see how she should react. And I'm sure, if I would have gotten upset or showed, if I would have showed a negative emotion, then she would have paired that negative emotion with, oh, okay, I made this mistake, or, okay, it's bad to fall in the toilet, which it is, but, you know. But the fact that we laughed at it, the worst-case scenario was that she fell in the toilet, and it was a joke, right?
Right.
So I think that when I think about a lot of the things that we tend to be afraid of in life, jumping out of a plane or, you know, going too fast on the freeway or whatever. Our rational mind say, you know, you think about probabilities, which is, you know, you're less likely to die from skydiving than you are from, you know, being in a traffic accident. But people are more fearful of jumping out of a plane. And it's a learned response, right? It's the social reaction to, okay, you shouldn't jump out of a plane.
You'd have to be crazy to do it, right?
Exactly. So when you think about, like, when you approach different activities and you think about, why am I really afraid of it? Like, what is at the foundation of this? And you realize that it's just really some social construct, and the worst case scenario is probably not that bad, then you can kind of brush that fear off pretty quickly.
Now, I totally resonate with the story you told about your daughter, actually. I mean, I know it as well from Marshall, my son. You know, when your kid falls over and bangs themselves, right, they don't cry straight away. They look up around, and they only start crying when they see concern on other people's faces, right? Or, you know, and I mean, depending on the nature of the injury. But what often happens, you know, they'll fall over, cut themselves, and then just look up. And if you're sort of like, oh, okay, well, you know, let's sort that out. The fear isn't so much there. The conditioned response, as you described it, that immediately, okay, you know, crying and fearfulness, that kind of dissipates quite quickly. One thing I wanted to dig into a little bit, because you started to touch already on some of these kind of practices. You talked about, you know, coming back to mindfulness, you know, and some other little practices you have to help yourself navigate, you know, times when you might be feeling some fear or some discomfort. I know, Charlene, that journaling is a big part of the work that you do, and that you have journaled for a long time. How do you use journaling to examine, you know, discomfort, fear, to think about courage, maybe even?
Like when I have a negative experience, yeah, journaling is a big part of my life. And just how I started out with that was I experienced a lot of traumatic stuff growing up. And for me, I would write about that traumatic experience and then change the ending in my journal, which gave me some kind of authority over it. Like, it gave me an outlet to change my own reality, basically. Yeah. And I think when you write stuff down, even though maybe it's different in kind of reality in terms of the real world, in your mind, it changes. Because whatever I write is reality to me. But now as I'm older, I use it by, you know, even when I experience something that I can't, I have strong emotions about something and I don't necessarily know where it is, then I'll just do kind of like a stream of consciousness writing on kind of everything that's, all the voices in my head that are going on, swirling around about whatever that particular incident is, and kind of just write for 5 or 10 minutes straight without stopping. And then I may put it down and then come back the second day and read it and kind of examine it more closely and maybe write some more, because things always pop out on the page when you just kind of let yourself go. But even, you know, me and Anna, we talk to each other in the journal all the time, too, some banter back and forth, like, you know, what it was that I ticked her off about that made her want to kill me this time. You know, you just kind of make fun with it. And it just shifts your disposition. I think it's really helpful for me. Because often, too, like when you share with other people as opposed to a journal, other people will project their own I don't know, idiosyncrasies on the situation. So sometimes it's not helpful to share with friends. I do like the ability to share with a coach, though, because coaches kind of reflect back to you on more of a from a more of a objective perspective and curiosity. So that's always helpful to me. But I don't share with friends a lot because they bring baggage to an already heavy situation.
Sure, and so I'm a coach, you're a coach. I think our experience of that is, you know, part of the professional role of a coach is to hold a non-judgmental space where their stuff is not so present. So it gives people a chance to really explore. Now, I'm reminded of the drama triangle, this Stephen Cartman model, I think, which is, you know, there's always kind of these interrelationships taking place, which are almost subconsciously taking place. And you know, this triangle has a persecutor at one corner, a rescuer and a victim. Mm-hmm. And when we enter into conversation with our friends, you know, in a non-professional context, often if we're talking about loss or difficult emotions, they can, you know, through their own learned behavior, they might step really easily into the rescuer model, right? They might step in and say, oh, you know, I can help, or have you tried this, or, you know, or they it might trigger them to feel into a victim mentality. They might also feel like, oh, wow, I've really experienced that. And then, you know, so I think the role of a professional coach, as I understand it too, is to kind of know their own shit, you know the stuff that they've got going on, and to kind of park that to one side to give their client, the person that they're working with, the space to explore in much the same way as the journal doesn't judge you, right? You know, right. The journal isn't there having the conversation back with you. It is you having the conversation with various parts of yourself. You know, I love the way you talk about Anna. I mean, I'm completely struck by this image of somebody who's a, you know, a homicide detective having a dialogue in journaling with a homicidal part of themselves. it's really a trip to hear about. I mean, it must be, you know, I think it really, you know, one reason I really wanted to get you on, Charlene, to have this conversation is, you know, I'd asked myself this question in my own journaling, you know, what are you lying to yourself about? Quite a good question, because it makes you feel quite uncomfortable too. So again, it's part of that courage practice, step into the difficult questions. And one of the answers was, you know, maybe I'm lying to myself about really being courageous. Perhaps I'm still in my comfort zone, but I'm just telling myself this is more courageous than what I was doing before, but it's still very much in my comfort zone. So I was exploring that a fair bit, and then I saw your article and I thought, wow, you know, there isn't really a choice for you. You have to, I would guess for almost everybody listening, for everybody out there, one thing that is definitively sitting outside of their comfort zone is death.
Yeah.
Is their own mortality. And so, yeah, it's not really a choice for you, right? You have to be outside of your comfort zone every day almost.
Yeah, well, the irony, though, is that I always tell people that. Did you know that 1 in 1 people will die in their lifetime?
Amazing.
So what I say is that I'm just more accepting of the fact that I have an expiration date, whereas a lot of people have the luxury of thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to live till I'm, you know, 75, 80, 90, maybe 100.
Sure.
So they have the luxury of, like, putting stuff off. Thinking they have time, but really nobody has time. Nobody knows when. I almost am more privileged by having this condition because I'm faced with it every day, so that I know that, you know, in terms of procrastinating or putting off today what I could do tomorrow, I may not have it tomorrow. Whereas
other
people assume that they'll have tomorrow, or assume that they have a week. And who knows, they could, you know, die in their sleep tomorrow with some unknown condition. At least I know what my condition is that might limit my
right.
Life. Other people don't know their hidden conditions.
What strikes me about that is it comes through so clearly that you have really made friends with Anna in that regard, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're keeping her close. You know, and having to have that conversation with her, you know, it's a real conversation. You're not sticking your head in the ground and saying, you know what, I'll be fine, I'll live till I'm 80, just like everybody else. You're really having to kind of courageously engage with this conversation about mortality. Maybe it doesn't feel like, you know, active courage in that way. It just feels like what's necessary. I'm reminded, I wouldn't consider myself a Buddhist necessarily, but I'm really interested in Buddhist practices, Buddhist ways of meditation and being in the world. And one of the practices I've been doing for a while now is called Maranasati. Maranasati is the Buddhist contemplation of death meditation. And what's interesting about it, a few different things. One is it's one of what's called four protective meditations. They're meditations that are kind of thought to be appropriate at any time. So no matter what you're experiencing in your life, there are these four protective meditations that can support you. And they sort of line up with, you know, Buddhism is obsessed with having four of this, eight of that, five of this. There's so many different lists to remember. But there's something called the five hindrances, things that kind of get in the way of your path on the Dharma, you know, your path to enlightenment. And one of those is sort of sloth, laziness, or procrastination, you know. And I loved what you said about, you know, your condition means that you wake up each day and say, I'm not going to put something off, right? So it's like an antidote towards procrastination. And in fact, Maranasati as a protective meditation is intended, one of the great benefits of it is to promote urgency in life. You know, and Buddhists talk about it as a way to promote urgency in your practice. Like, don't wait, you know, till tomorrow to try and, you know, sit down and meditate. Do it today because you might not have tomorrow. So the focus for Maranasati is on like combating this like laziness or apathy or lack of engagement by actively contemplating the death of yourself. And then also, you know, in the practice more widely, what I found fascinating and actually very challenging, you know, if we talk about where our comfort zone sits, thinking about my own death, meditating on my own death hasn't been a problem, right? I've thought about it a lot. I've meditated on it a lot. You know, parts of the practice get pretty in depth, you know, you start to meditate on the decomposition of the corpse, your own corpse and things. I mean, it's really wild meditation, I've got to say. There's lots of, you know, it's quite an interesting thing. And as you kind of extend the practice, you start to think about, okay, well, now could I contemplate the death of somebody close to me? And it's at that point, actually, that in my own practice of late, I've started, you know, really hitting up against, you know, basically a barrier, you know, a comfort barrier, because I think the death of a loved one remains a fear for me, you know, and I haven't yet figured out the way to not to forget about that fear, not to kind of make it go away, but just to be with that fear, right? The death of my son, for example, the death of my wife or my dad. And yeah. So, you know, I really feel, you know, interestingly, you know, and I'm conscious of our time, we'll wrap up shortly. Interestingly, so throughout the month of January, I've chosen this topic, courage, to focus on. And it's been a tremendous thing to have a kind of one key area of focus. Suddenly my lens on everything is through courage. I'm practicing courage. I'm looking for courage. I'm having this conversation with you about courage. And in February, I'm choosing a different topic. And that topic's going to be death, actually. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the reason I've chosen February is the anniversary of my mum's death. And so my own experience with mortality, I don't have, you know, I love the way you describe it, the privilege of a diagnosis that reminds me of my mortality every day. And so I step into this Maranasati practice, this way of trying to kind of cultivate urgency, cultivate a sense of acceptance about the fact that I'm just, you know, I am of the same nature as everything else in the world that decays, right? And so I've had the benefit, and I actually describe it as a privilege too. So I really, that language really resonates. It's a privilege that my mum passed away and I've had time to become really familiar and close to death. And so I can really understand what you say when you talk about this sense of bringing it closer and using it as a kind of, as a tool almost, as a practice. Wow, what a conversation. I'm so glad you said yes to having this conversation, Charlene.
Yeah, it's been great. I wish we had more time because I've got like so many more questions for you.
Perfect. Listen, there's nothing to stop us doing another one of these. Let's check our calendars and line something up.
Okay. Definitely.
Thanks again for sharing so much. Just before we sign off, if people are interested in the work that you do, is there anywhere they can find out about what you do?
I have a website. It's called I Am Serious, CERUS.com. And I'm also on Instagram at the same I Am Serious. But yeah, that's it.
Amazing. Charlene, thank you so much for your time. I hope that you have lots of great conversations with Anna over the next few days.
Well, I hope she's asleep for a while, but yeah.
She can quieten down for a little while.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, good talking, Charlene, to you. Thanks so much. Be courageous. And we'll catch up again soon.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye now.